Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Attorney General nominee Loretta Lynch moves closer to confirmation. The Senate approves the Keystone XL pipeline, setting up a fight with the White House, and two former Vanderbilt football players are convicted of rape. Joining me for the Domestic Hour of the Friday News Roundup, Susan Davis of USA Today, Ron Elving of NPR, and for the first time on the Friday News Roundup, Kelly O'Donnell of NBC News. And we will be taking your call throughout the hour, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And for those of you who'd like to see what's going on in our studio, you can go to drshow.org and click on Streaming Live. Welcome, Kelly, and welcome to all of you.
Hello, Diane.
So good to be with you.
Good morning, Diane. I'm delighted to have you here. Ron Elving, let's start with sequestration. President Obama wants to call an end to all those automatic budget cuts.
Sequestration has never been very popular, possibly including as a word. It's just not one that most people want to wake up to hear. But it goes back to the 1970s and the wars between Richard Nixon and a Democratic Congress. And the president said that he didn't actually have to spend all the money that Congress appropriated. So that made Congress very upset. And these kinds of issues resurface whenever Congress and the president get in a real bind. And we got in this bind, of course, a few years ago. We had fiscal cliffs. We had big deals. And one of the ways that they got to a way of controlling the deficit was to have this sequestration of certain amounts of money. And it bit particularly hard on the Defense Department. And that's really the political rub here, because there are a lot of Republicans who feel as though we are literally gutting the ability of our Defense Department to carry out its mandates around the world, including uniformed personnel.
So the chances of Congress eliminating those automatic budget cuts, Kelly?
Well, politically, the difficult part is for those, especially conservatives, who don't want to see the government spend another dollar that's unnecessary. That has been somewhat politically helpful for them. But the day-to-day reality in talking to members is that they share the concerns you just raised. What is happening to the Department of Defense? There isn't enough time. It is not an agency and a department that can easily move back when it gets more funding. It is a huge ship to turn. And so they feel that there is an urgent need. We heard testimony about it this week. And I think the political will is shifting toward, even if it isn't across the board, that addressing what the Department of Defense needs is really a hot button topic.
But at the same time, the president says he wants to increase the budget by 7%, Susan.
Right, it's 7%, about $74 billion above the current discretionary spending. It would increase the defense budget by about $38 billion for the next fiscal year, which starts in October. I don't think that there is any opposition to increasing defense spending. But if the answer is just to turn the sequester off, that's not going to happen. Republicans aren't going to vote for that. And if the only Democratic acceptable way to turn it off is to raise taxes, that's not going to happen because Republicans won't vote for that. And we talk a lot about the defense cuts, but Democrats also point to the other side of the budget, the discretionary side, as we call it. This is what funds NIH, what funds the CDC, which funds the Department of Education. And in these prior budget cuts, as Ron referred to, the budget bill of 2011, the other deals, the discretionary budget in this country has been cut pretty lean. You know, a lot of these popular programs don't really have a lot more to cut. So the only way to really get at it is if we get back to talking about grand bargain. If everybody gets to the table and we'll talk revenue and spending cuts, entitlement reform, and it is just very hard to see that another grand bargain talk happening
and
in this Congress.
And the president certainly got some pushback on trying to get rid of 529s as a tax break.
Oh, what a head-shaking moment on that. Here's a way for families to put money away and to look at competing priorities in people's lives, wanting to save, wanting to do something responsible, and at a time when many people are advocating for greater access to education and more competitive students. this was a quick and swift death to an Obama policy.
Yeah, he backed away from that immediately. How did that come about, Ron?
It came about because Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, leader of the Democrats in the Congress, and also some of her campaign people like Chris Van Hollen, said, you know, we really don't want to do this. This is not a group of voters we want to offend. Now, one of the reasons the Obama people thought this was a good way to illustrate the difficulties of tax reform was because a lot of the people, most of the people who really benefit from this are upper-income people. And the Democrats, you know, theoretically should be worrying more about the people at the lower end of the base, the people with the income inequality. But there are a lot of different definitions of income inequality, and if the people who are taking advantage of this to send their kids to college include a lot of people who are Democratic voters, and they do, then that's going to lose the support of the Democrats, and it's not a good battleground.
Interesting that the GAO reports nearly half of those with 529 plans made more than $150,000 a year with median assets of $413,000.
That's right. These are people in the upper middle class. They're people who have done well and probably have college educations themselves and very much want that for their kids. If the idea is access to college, the Obama administration would have said, we should be worrying more about the people at the community college level. In the course, they're trying to finance free tuition for 2 years of community college. And these are the people they should be worrying about. But, of course, it's always broader than that. And everyone's definition of middle class is a little different.
All right. And let's turn to the hearing before which Loretta Lynch appeared, the Senate Judiciary, that question kept coming up, are you Eric Holder?
I think that she performed exceedingly well. I think that she was relatively unknown. She's never been under that kind of national spotlight. Republicans, who I think were very much geared up for this hearing to be very critical, use it as a vehicle to be very critical of the DOJ that was run by Eric Holder, were not able to throw her off her feet in any which way. I think that she's going to clear the committee. I think that's a foregone conclusion. At least two Republicans, Orrin Hatch and Jeff Flake, have come out and said they will support her. They have found no disqualifying aspect to her record or her character. What I think is interesting is that the committee hearing was almost the easy part. If you think about the next 2 years of what's facing DOJ, the stockpile of issues she's walking into, the relationships with community policing after Ferguson, the voting rights bill that has lapsed, cybercrime, which we've seen being talked about, and there's going to be a push to enhance the nation's cybersecurity laws. I mean, she is really going to have an incredibly intense 2 years at the top of DOJ.
If, in fact, her approval, her confirmation is a foregone conclusion, why is it going to take until March to do this?
Well, I think there is a process, and people who are on the committee and in the Senate value that process more than the everyday person. So the hearings, in which she performed incredibly well, I've watched lots of hearings, I sat through hers, she was immensely poised. And what you did note is that Republicans who are critical about the department were careful to try to praise her personal accomplishments and her record. What they were also trying to do was to litigate against the Department of Justice and issues they're concerned about, and to get her on record. And where she created some friction with predictable foes on the other side of the table was a reluctance for her to say too much in a hypothetical situation and to say too much about boundaries of executive power, things that are clearly on the minds of conservatives. And so it is a long dance. She's met with a number of these senators personally. She will meet with those not on the committee as we move along. It takes time, but she performed very well.
What about the question of torture?
This is one where she, again, the Democrats really should have made up buttons that said, Je suis Loretta, because they should have all been wearing that, because her answer again and again was, I'm not Eric Holder. I'm not going to slice it the way he did. I'm going to do it the way I would do it, and I am independent of the president. There was a specific question about torture, and she was asked, is waterboarding torture? And she said, as clearly as anyone could say, unequivocally, waterboarding is torture. It is illegal.
Distancing herself from Eric Holder is not a simple thing to do, given the life history and the path and the professional life she's led. And she did that very clearly, at least rhetorically. We'll have to see what her record will be. But that was not an easy thing to do, and she knew she had to do it. And she again emphasized her independence from the White House. That'll be a test. Will she truly be independent? She spoke very clearly about why she would, what her thought process would be, and that it is her responsibility to be independent. The question that Eric Holder has raised in the minds of so many who are frustrated with his performance in that office is that he once referred to himself as the president's wingman, a term of art that many people understand, but not helpful in this context.
And at the same time, some on the committee kept asking whether she would resign.
Yes, and I don't think that that's really, I mean, that's a strange question to ask someone at a confirmation hearing,
exactly.
Is it not? Obviously, the fallout with Holder reached the point where the House actually cited him for contempt of Congress, which is a pretty serious matter. Of course, the problem is that actually carrying that forward to a prosecution depends on the Department of Justice, which he runs. So that relationship was about as bad as it could possibly be, but that's still a very strange question.
Ron Helving of NPR. Short break here. Your calls, your comments. When we come back, stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which believes that the lives of the world's poorest will improve faster in the next 15 years than at any other time in history, as described in the Foundation's annual letter at gatesletter.org.
Welcome back here in the studio, Ron Helving of NPR, Kelly O'Donnell of NBC News, and Susan Davis of USA Today. You can see all of our guests on our live video stream at drshow.org. I hope you'll join us. You can also give us a call. 800-433-8850. Kelly, the Senate Banking Committee voted yesterday for a bill that would toughen sanctions on Iran, but 10 Democrats announced that they would hold off and give negotiations more time.
Well, the White House believes that any action by Congress now could interfere with the international process they have going, because there are other nations involved. This is not U.S. direct with Iran, and that there is a limited amount of time left before the next deadline, and to not rock the boat, so to speak. Well, there are people in Congress who think that that is not a sufficient strategy, and that the pressure Congress can bring to bear to send a very predictable signal. It should not be a surprise to Iran that Congress would toughen sanctions if they fail to act. But this is where Congress sees itself very much as a co-equal branch of government and wants to keep that pressure up, to say that their concern is that Iran may be just trying to stall. and by showing action and by pushing the White House as well as those involved in the talks, that that could be effective. And the power of the message to say it is not enough. And also a message to our friends in Israel and others around the world who are similarly concerned about the nuclear fate of Iran.
Susan.
I agree with that completely. I think one really interesting player in all this is Robert Menendez, who has been probably the toughest Democratic critique of the White House in the
Absolutely.
Way that they have been negotiating on this. I think that there is a very low level of confidence on Capitol Hill that these negotiations are going to ultimately be successful. So I think that they wanted to start moving on a dual track. I think it's very likely that they will there will be a vote on this not in the end of March if they fail. And it's very it seems very likely that they will have enough votes and support that it could override a veto.
And what about the fallout on the invitation by House Speaker Boehner to Benjamin Netanyahu?
Yes. Well, this is going to have to be seen in a lot of context because this is a relationship that goes back a long way. Netanyahu came in 1996 after his first election as prime minister in Israel and spoke to the Newt Gingrich Congress, the House and Senate. That was a newly Republican Senate as well. And that was quite an event. But it was perhaps not seen in quite the same personal terms towards President Clinton, although obviously there was some tension there as well, because President Clinton had not already had years of conflict with Bibi Netanyahu. He was a brand new prime minister, and there was this kind of relationship being set up there between the House Republicans in particular, but congressional Republicans in general, to show their bona fides on Israel and also to sort of catch some of the charisma that the very early Netanyahu had. Now we're in a totally different situation. Almost 20 years later, Netanyahu's back. He is facing an election himself. The tension now is all entirely between him and President Obama, which has been a bad relationship for 6 years.
And I find it fascinating that the former Israeli ambassador to the U.S., wrote or said he thinks it's a bad idea for Benjamin Netanyahu to come here now when Israel faces its own elections 2 weeks from now, Kelly.
When you think of the larger U.S. relationship with Israel, it's striking to think that any time the prime minister would want to come would be a problem. And yet in this moment, it carries a lot of political baggage. Too close to his election, there is a standard protocol that these sorts of international guests are not here at a time when it would look like it's a finger on the scale for politics in their home country. And at the same time, it has such an important message for those who want to keep pressure on the White House, especially about its role in that part of the world, and to send a message that especially members of Congress are united with Israel. And there are many constituencies and coalitions in that long relationship that you were talking about. It is one of those very polite sticks in the eye.
I think the optics of it are also remarkable when you consider that it's the same pulpit that Barack Obama gave a State of the Union address just a couple weeks ago and called against moving forward on sanctions and gave a very forceful speech, and then to invite the Israeli prime minister to address Congress from that exact same place and may potentially undermine the president of the United States' same very message.
On the other hand, it may rally Democrats to the president's side on this very issue of the Iran negotiations.
It's possible, although I think it's notable that Netanyahu also has a lot of his own personal relationships with members of Congress. And Harry Reid, for example, was asked, what do you think about him coming to speak? And he gave sort of a nonplussed answer and said, you know, I like Netanyahu. He called me after I hurt my eye and asked me to see if I was doing okay, and we'll see what he has to say.
Do you think, with all the pressure he's hearing, he may change his mind?
I don't know. He does not seem like the personality type to back down. And I do not get the sense that the speaker or the majority leader are interested in disinviting him. So as of right now, it seems like it's on track.
You know, it's possible that that could happen. But there's a lot of talk in Israel that there is a kind of implicit support here from a lot of America for him. At least some people read it that way. If he suddenly decided not to come, that would look as though somehow he had lost that lift. He had lost that sense that the Americans were with him.
All right, let's talk about the Senate vote on the Keystone XL pipeline, Susan?
Oh, the Keystone pipeline. So it finally passed on Thursday with 62 votes. It was a little bit of political theater in that it's going to be vetoed, and they don't have the votes to overcome it. But it was, I think, in some ways, a catharsis in the Senate. This has been one of these issues that they just get it over with.
Yeah.
And it does have notable bipartisan support. It has been something that they have been fighting about for 6 years. The Keystone pipeline unto itself is not a significant energy infrastructure project, but it has become this symbolic issue where Democrats say it has become a symbol of Republicans being the party of big oil, and Democrats are the party that wants to move beyond fossil fuels. And the project itself is a relatively small-scale energy infrastructure project. It's not a long-term jobs project. It's not going to fundamentally lower our dependence on oil. But I also think it's probably going to get built at the end of the day. Remember that the administration's argument has been that they do not want to be taken out of the process, the decision process. And that decision process is still underway in the State Department and is moving very quickly. And the State Department could announce as early as next month their final ruling on this project. So I think it's possible Obama can veto the pipeline and then build the pipeline.
Kelly.
That's the best of all worlds.
Yeah.
Part of what was happening, too, with this, it has taken on symbolism, but it was also becoming a symbol of, can a new Congress work differently? And Republicans put a big priority on having an open amendment process where there were roughly 40 votes, more than in all of the 113th Congress. And so trying to put down a marker to say, the Senate can operate and can invite the minority party, now Democrats, to have their say. And while that might not be so interesting in the outside world, very, very interesting in the halls of Congress, where you had even Democrats gleeful that they could author an amendment and have it considered, and a chance to have the sort of debate and the process that even if you don't look at it as what will matter in this particular instance, did it bring some new relationships? And those new relationships could have an impact on other pieces of legislation. If you find a way to look across the chamber and see someone you might not have had a personal relationship with or a political alliance, and you find a moment, a topic, a way to work together, that always leads to better relationships down the line. So I'm hopeful that it has some benefits that could redound later on.
Yeah, Kelly has really identified one of the things that's been missing in the Senate in recent years, and that's the cross-aisle relationships between individual senators. Also, one of the things that happened to come up in these 40 amendments was an amendment that said climate change is real, it's not a hoax. And they got everybody in the Senate save one to vote for that, including, obviously, virtually all the Republicans. They also had another amendment that also passed that said human beings are contributing to climate change. Now, that's moving the Senate down the road on an awfully important issue going down to our future for a very long time. So just to get them that far, they didn't want to say it was significantly, that was still splitting the Senate. They didn't want to say it was significantly human activity that was causing climate change.
That one word
was still too hot.
Yeah.
But the fact that we got as far as we did, we got some Republicans even for significantly, that shows real change. That's the kind of thing the Senate can do, even if we don't build the Keystone pipeline until later on. But I think that Susan's right. Eventually, this pipeline might very well get built in some form, at least if the price of oil recovers enough to make the oil sands profitable.
Okay. I want to ask you all about the politics of the response to the storm that did not hit New Jersey and New York. What do you think, Susan? I mean, you're darned if you do, darned if you don't.
That's exactly what I'm thinking. And I think what's funny, not funny, but the national weather forecasters, a number of them, after the storm did not develop the way they said, were tweeting these sort of mea culpas, like, we're sorry that we thought, because they were off by some estimates, 20 to 30 inches.
Except in Boston and on
But New York City was where I think that we saw it the most, because that is a metropolis that has to shutting down the roads, the law enforcement.
For the first time to close down the subway.
Yes.
First time in history.
But like you said, if they did not take those measures and 30 inches came into the city and people were stranded in subways and people were being hurt in the streets,
de Blasio,
it would be a fiasco for de Blasio.
Awful. What do you think?
Well, he'd have been the Michael Blandick of our day, and that's a name most people don't even remember, but he was the mayor of Chicago after Richard J. Daley, and he did not think a snowstorm was going to be a big deal, and that was the end of Michael Bland.
And what about Marion Barry out in Los Angeles when D.C. was shoveling snow?
We have an expectation now that our executives, whether it's your mayor, your governor, or your president, will be the official face of an impending natural crisis, a storm, a tornado, whatever it might be. And we expect now that they will be the voice of calm and they will be the emergency management planners. So if it doesn't go as predicted, they pay a severe political price. And we have seen that exacted over the last several years. So if they fail to act and you've got cars in Atlanta trapped on the roads for ridiculous length of time, people remember that. So it's a cost-benefit analysis. If it is too great a cost to shut down a city that never sleeps, like New York, they would not have done it. I think the new test will be, is there a cry-wolf quotient that is hard to measure, and it'll be hard to see how it runs out politically. But I think if people can be patient enough and find a way to realize that we've seen the cost to first responders to try to save people who didn't use good judgment on their own, or through no fault of their own were trapped, there are costs that are associated with that. And so trying to look like you're out front of it seems to be a better choice politically for leaders now.
And speaking of making choices, you've got the Federal Aviation Administration saying there will be no drones at the Super Bowl in the same week. A small vehicle ends up on the White House lawn.
$500 worth of drone. This is a strange story. We have kind of a very low-key explanation for it at this point, that somebody was playing with this thing at 3 o'clock in the morning and got out his window and he brought it back in and it went back out his window again, according to the narrative that we have at this point. And then it just took off. Flew straight up into the air and disappeared. And everyone involved said, well, gee, we'll have to find it tomorrow, and went to sleep. And in the morning, discovered that the White House Secret Service detail had found it for them on the White House grounds. That's got to be pretty good definition of bad breakfast viewing, to see your drone found there.
Now, I love that you built in so many opportunities for the story to change. That I really like.
Because you know, as I say, I mean, it's a weird story right now, and it's probably going to get weirder. But one thing we know is that it is possible for people with a very small amount of money to get their hands on some drones, not nearly as sophisticated, obviously, the ones that the Department of Defense is using, but stuff that can go places and drop unpredictably and do bad things.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I would think, Susan, that security at Super Bowl is just horrendously important and huge.
Yeah, and my understanding is that the ban on drones is a 60-mile radius around the stadium, which almost seems
and they keep
overly
changing
cautious.
Their tactics day after day after day, thinking, how can we better protect the Super Bowl?
But, you know, this is exactly what we were talking about with New York in the storm. You know, if you are in charge, and the law enforcement that's involved in a Super Bowl, it's on a federal level, it's on a state level. I mean, if something
corporate
were to happen
level.
There, corporate level, the insurance level. And I think that we would rather be overly precautious, overly safe, than have someone get hurt on live national television. And it's just the world we live in.
All right. And finally, before we take our break, Kelly O'Donnell, two former Vanderbilt University football players have been convicted of rape. Talk about that case.
Well, it is very troubling because I think what we are seeing now is that the whole sort of social dynamic about how cases are reported, what's happening on campuses, what's happening with student athletes, there is a real almost panic on campuses, I think, now about where is the line for how you report and who is believed and how does this play out. We've seen cases where women are also put through a situation of the doubt question. What is a responsibility of the university? How much do they know? And I think it just tears open that that sort of heartbreak over what do you do?
But in this case, Ron, the evidence was hard to dismiss.
There was a security camera that caught this woman apparently unconscious being carried into a building. And the parties who were tried were seen in this video, or were identified at least as having been. This is a difficult case because a lot of the people who were immediately involved, including the victim, really can't testify as to what exactly happened because they really don't have much memory of it. Obviously, alcohol was a major factor in this, and this has led a lot of schools, of course, not only because of this incident, but many, many, many other incidents, to review their alcohol policies. I understand Dartmouth has just banned hard liquor. This is probably going to cause not just soul searching, but changes in rules and policies, some of which have been in place in the sense that they're really kind of non-existent, back to the old days of loco parentis. In loco parentis, when prior to the 1960s, most colleges, as a matter of routine, had various and sundry parietal rules and tried to monitor the behavior of their students and tried to protect women in a way that's just really unthinkable today. But maybe we're going to go back to some of that.
All right. Short break here. When we come back, time to open the phone.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from PBS with Earth, A New Wild, a new five-part series that takes a look at humanity's relationship with wild places on Earth and explores the future of nature. Earth, A New Wild premieres Wednesday at 9, 8 Central on PBS. And from Staples with copy and print solutions for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom framed prints and posters. More at Staples Stores or Staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the International Hour, the Friday News Roundup, a new government in Greece moves to reverse austerity reforms, new fighting erupts between Russian-backed separatists and Ukraine, and President Obama visits India and Saudi Arabia. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. Time to open the phones. You can see our guests, Kelly O'Donnell, Ron Elving, Susan Davis, if you go to drshow.org and watch through our live video stream. Let's go first to Tomasina in Ormond Beach, Florida. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Regarding the Keystone Pipeline, we shouldn't allow oil pipelines or drilling near our food and water resources. We've had chemical and oil spills in record numbers the past couple of years, and this dirty tar sands oil is the wrong oil in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Susan Davis.
I think that she hits on a part of the reason why I think that Democrats are so forcefully opposed to this. I was in Philadelphia yesterday for the House Democrats' annual retreat, and President Obama came and spoke, and there was protesters outside of the hotel, and it was notable to me that the main signs that they were holding was opposing the Keystone Pipeline. I think that we haven't really heard a lot from sort of the environmental wing of the Democratic Party, because because we have not been having a lot of environmental debates, but this really strikes at the heart of that, and there is a lot of core opposition to it.
All right, to Eric in Madison, Wisconsin, you're on the air.
Yes, I have a comment and a question.
Sure.
Okay, my comment is that there seems to be a relationship between flat wages and the accumulation of wealth to the 1%. In 1972, the 1% owned roughly 17% of the wealth in America, and the wages in America were at their highest level. Per capita income was at its highest level ever. Since then, wages have been flat. Per capita income has fallen, and now that same 1% that owns 72% of the wealth owns 40% of the wealth. At the rate that we're going, by 2055, the 1% will own 90% of the wealth.
Okay, so your question.
My question is, would the people in the media please ask Republican lawmakers, who are the authors of this because of various laws they've passed regarding weakening unions and changing tax law, to please address this question.
All right, Kelly, I'm sure you have.
Well, one of the things we're finding is that Republicans are talking more about middle-class concerns than the typical Chamber of Commerce country club branch of the party that has been so much of its backbone. I think there's a recognition that it is not good for the country to have wages be flat for so long. The answer really is differing, and how do you get there? Certainly, the president talked a lot about wanting to change some of the tax code to make inherited wealth more taxable, to try to deal with that. That doesn't go well for Republicans. I think the fact that there's an acknowledgement in both parties that middle-class suffering and middle-class feeling behind is real and must be addressed is something that works politically as well as the importance it plays in our economy.
Here's an email from Mike. Your guest could not be more right about campuses being in a state of panic. Look no further than the story in the Washington Post this week about how national sororities have ordered their members at UVA to stay home this Saturday, which is the occasion of the annual bid night for new fraternity pledges. In loco parentis is right.
There's a long way to go to get back to 1955. I don't think that the country is going back there by any means. But I do think that there's also a tendency for people to assume that life is always going to continue exactly the way it has on college campuses. And certainly this problem, abuse of women in particular, abuse of alcohol in particular, has been with us for a very long time. It does seem to have intensified. It does seem to go up and down. And the University of Virginia story, of course, a whole nother kettle of fish to talk about. But this story from Vanderbilt, the other things that the national fraternities and sororities are doing to try to discourage the more truly abusive practices of deliberately trying to get people drunk to the point of unconsciousness. I would say even the Bill Cosby story has played into this to some degree. The sense that there was a boys will be boys forgiveness for the idea of sexual assault through the use of chemicals, whether those be, you know, some sort of something that's dropped into a drink or whether it's the drink itself.
Where is the Bill Cosby story going? Do we know?
It seems like from everything we've heard, it's unlikely to ever reach a criminal level, that so many of these allegations are past the statute of limitations or they are not seeking to press charges. It's unclear if he will ever have to, you know, answer illegally to the charges, but it has obviously fundamentally changed his celebrity brand and his business interests.
All right. To Phyllis in Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi there.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
Thank you. I wanted to go back to the Netanyahu story, if I may. I'm Jewish. I'm a Zionist. And so I have always, and I know that the Congress, both Republicans and Democrats have always favored Israel. So that's not a question. I think Mr. Netanyahu understands the protocol as well as anybody in his position would with regard to accepting invitations. I know he's here for the AIPAC conference, which is fine. They can invite whomever they please. But this was a great mistake on Mr. Netanyahu's part, and I think it might behoove him to call the president or write a note and explain his reasoning for accepting this invitation without having it come from the White House.
Susan Davis.
I think that's a really interesting point. I hadn't, and it's good to hear that input. I do think that what we don't know is what Netanyahu is going to say. And I think where there may be blowback on him and on Congress is if he goes too aggressively against the president to a Congress on his home turf. I think he could really overstep bounds. Again, I just don't see him not addressing Congress at this point, but the relationship between he and the president seems so fractured.
What about the effects on his election back home?
This is something I don't think any of us is in a very good position to assess, because there are obviously people in Israel who feel that this is out of line. They're probably not fans of Bibi Netanyahu and never have been. There are many people in that country who think that he is not leading them in the right direction towards peace. And there is a large peace community in Israel. It doesn't get nearly as much attention as the people who are in charge right now, but they have been in charge at times in the past, and they have taken a different approach with respect to the Palestinians, with respect to the two-state solution. And this is a real election. And for anybody to be putting a big thumb on the scale from the United States on any side is obviously going to be seen by some people in Israel as interference on that side.
All right, let's go to John in Salisbury, Maryland. Hi there.
Hi, good morning. Yes, I want to make a comment on the college savings plans.
Sure.
I hear the term middle class thrown around. I'm actually not sure what President Obama considers middle class. I consider myself middle class and not even upper. I make about $140,000 a year, but I work 6 and 7 days a week, and the reason I do that is because I got zapped with the Great Recession. I have two mortgages. I could never sell a house, and I have three kids in college, and they consider me making too much money to get them any grants or anything like that. So I'm trying to get them out of school without any debt, so I'm paying as I go. I heard the term responsibility earlier, and I feel like I'm being punished for being responsible, and it kind of depresses me. You know, I worry when I hear terms like means testing. You know, I do have a 401k. It is building up, and I don't want to be told at retirement age in 10 to 15 years, oh, well, good for you. You saved some money, and we're not going to give you any Social Security because you're doing well, and we're going to give it to somebody else, you know, things like that. So it just bothers me.
Boy, is that a powerful story.
Your comments encapsulate so much of what
exactly. People
are feeling, who are squeezed. They're trying to do the right thing. Their W-2 may look impressive,
yeah. But
the responsibilities that are on them, caring for elderly parents, trying to pay for college, being at an income threshold where you don't get any breaks. So you're paying full retail for college. That's expensive. And so I think it really has touched a nerve with that middle part of the earning scale where people have demonstrated success. They have their own college debts they, in some cases, are still paying off, and trying to care for families and pay for mortgages and do all of those things that we say are important to be good citizens, to have a mortgage, to care for your children, and to work hard. Working 6 and 7 days a week doesn't feel like someone who would define themselves as financially well off.
I think that John hits on what could be a very core issue of the 2016 presidential campaign, and you see both sides talking about this now. And it's almost a politically unanswerable question is, what is middle class? How do you define it? And as soon as you start to put a dollar figure on it, which they did with the 529 plan this week, and you saw how quickly that was repudiated and dismissed, that by any statistical measure, a guy like John is considered wealthy in this country. But then when you list his financial obligations and hear his story, you realize, you know, can you raise taxes on that guy? Is that what Democrats want to do? And I think that was the jam that they found themselves in this week.
All right, to Brandon in Cincinnati, Ohio. Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, how you doing?
Good.
Great panel as always.
Thanks.
I just had a comment to make on the drone issue. It kind of seems like we're in the Wild West phase of the drone. I was wondering, I feel like we're going to see a lot more news stories about these predicaments we're getting in with the White House this past week. And I was wondering if there's any precedent for governmental action. It feels like they're kind of figuring out what to do with the entire issue. And I was wondering if there's any precedents for this technology.
Susan.
There is no precedent, and it is under review. The Federal Aviation Administration is currently in the process, and it sounds like it's going to be delayed into later this year, possibly even into next.
Really?
Setting.
I thought they were coming out with their report.
They have been coming out with bits and pieces of things that they are considering, and I think in some ways it's trial balloons to see how the business community
no
and
pun
others.
Intended.
But that they in terms of how do you set a federal policy for these drones? Because and do you try and set standards that are similar to model aircraft is what we were talking about the earlier White House drone incident. Is that more of a sort of a model airplane, or is that how do you classify it? By what heights can they fly at? Can they be detected by radar? I mean, all of these questions, the Wild West of the drone era is a great way to put it.
Absolutely.
In that the legal questions it raises and the regulation standards by which they're going to be measured by are totally unclear.
And aren't sales going
yes,
through the
and,
roof?
And not only, independent enthusiast
so
sales,
to speak.
But Hollywood, Amazon that's talking about drone delivery. I mean, the business community is very eagerly looking at these standards because they are trying to apply the drone business model to their industries, but they want the federal government to tell them what they can and can't do with them first.
And it's not just a question of the White House or Washington, D.C. It's every airport in America
yeah.
is wondering about these things. We get pilot reports all the time that they were trying to land and they saw something tracking them and it turned out to be some kind of drone, or that's what they think. So, yes, this is the new dimension of fear from the skies. And there are these precedents, at least, that you cannot fly a small private airplane over Washington, D.C. You can't just fly into the area. There are no fly zones around the city.
Right.
And there's a precedent there. So, of course, it seems a little draconian to apply that to every little model aircraft and every little hovering vehicle, but that is the precedent that will ultimately probably be brought to bear if we don't want to have these things everywhere.
All right, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Roger in Utopia, Texas. Hi, you're on the air. What's Utopia like, Roger?
Utopia is very beautiful. About
good.
Yes, it should be.
Good. Wonderful.
My comment is basically, I'll try to make it short and encapsulated.
May I interrupt yeah. for just one
sure.
moment? New York Times is reporting that Romney will not run mm-hmm. for president. I think that's something we expected. Please excuse me, Roger.
No,
go right ahead.
Actually, that is actually right in line with what I was about to say. Mm-hmm. You know, when I've come to the conclusion that Republicans don't believe their own mantra. When Obama ran the first time, there was lots of doom and gloom predicted by the Republicans that things would be terrible if Obama had his way, and that after he was elected, they did everything they could do to fight him. But if they really believed that, they would let him have his way, let him fail spectacularly, and then run on the "I told you so" ticket for the second campaign. In the same sense, you see the delay on the confirmation for Lynch. I think Eric Holder is far more valuable to the Republicans as a whipping boy over the next couple of months than she is. They like to complain. They don't like to govern. And I think you see a history of it.
Kelly.
Well, I understand your point, and I think that Eric Holder has traction in conservative circles, and I think they have a long point to make because they feel that their battle with him has not been really joined by the other side, and Loretta Lynch was very, very impressive. I think the Romney news is quite interesting in that he gave a very full-throated three-week attempt to regain his standing in the party.
What do you think might have changed his mind?
I think there have been two worlds for Mitt Romney. I think in the time since he lost up until this most recent period, what he frequently heard from people in his world, you would have made a great president, you were right on this issue, you were right on that issue. And so he heard that regularly from people who genuinely believed he would have done a fine job had he been elected. And then you get into the wider audience of Republican donors and potential voters, who many of whom respected him, but there is that feeling of wanting a new face. Then you had Romney supporters who said, but by the time we get to the voting, no one will be a new face. Jeb Bush is not a new face, or some of the other prominent names in the very wide field. And so there was a belief that he could contest this. I think he's had a chance to talk to donors and had a chance to assess how he would perform again, and the claim that he could be a different candidate was a hard sell for many people, even if he learned from his experiences.
And maybe talking with his wife.
Well, Ann Romney had often said she was not up for another run, and then we got sort of signals that she would be. Yes, you can never know what happens in those conversations, but I think even outside of the family, I think there were probably people who said your standing in the party would be greater if you step aside.
And good decision.
Yes, I think it's probably a good decision from Mitt Romney's point of view, from Ann Romney's point of view, and from the Republican Party's point of view, because they don't really want a contest between Romney and Bush. They want a contest between Bush and a large field of challengers to Bush, which the establishment at least believes Bush will win and therefore be a stronger candidate against Hillary Clinton.
So are we already naming the candidates for 2016?
There are two frontrunners, and the frontrunner in the Democratic Party is prohibitively the frontrunner, and no one else is really running. And in the Republican Party, we have Jeb Bush, who has all of the deficits that we all know about, but who is head and shoulders above the rest of the crowd in terms of fundraising, in terms of connections, and in terms of likelihood of being nominated.
All right. You heard it here. Ron Elving, Kelly O'Donnell, Susan Davis. Thank you all so much. Great show.
Thank you, Diane.
Wonderful to be with you.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.